Your true crime podcast keeps listeners on the edge of their seats. But here's the real mystery. Why isn't it making more money? Odyssey Creator Lab is here to solve that. We host your show for free. No fees, no catch. You focus on the suspense while our sales team brings in advertisers and revenue. Stop leaving money on the table. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and turn your passion for true crime into real revenue.
97.1 FM Talk.
On demand audio.
Hey, welcome back. It's Joe Beamer in for Mark Reardon here on 97.1 FM Talk, my final broadcast of 2025. Let's make it count, ladies and gentlemen. And to kick things off, Jim Talent. He is a former U.S. Senator from the state of Missouri, and he joins us now. Jim, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, Joe. Let's see if I can help you go out on a high note here.
Oh, I know you will, my friend. Let's start with the president's meetings with world leaders, and let's start with the Zelensky meeting on Sunday. It seems like, you know, every month or so we have these meetings, we have, you know, discussions, and then for the next month we don't hear anything. What did you take away from that meeting, and where do you believe we stand in this conflict?
Yeah, solving this one is the toughest nut to crack. I think the president acknowledged that a couple of months ago and said, as a matter of fact, he said, I thought it would be a lot easier than it's been. And I think you have to step to understand that you have to step back and look at the overall situation. I mean, this war has been a disaster on a geostrategic level for Russia. Russia wanted to divide NATO. Now Finland and Sweden are in NATO. The Europeans are not relying on Russian energy anymore, at least as a policy. Going forward, the Europeans evidently are going to spend more money on defense, which is the last thing Putin wanted. Syria is gone as an ally because Putin couldn't reinforce Bashar Assad. Assad is now in Moscow playing video games. And he's lost a million men, and the Russian army's been exposed, basically, as a weak force. And so the problem is, the minute Putin signs an agreement that contains anything other than his maximal demands, he takes the L. The only thing he's got left in this war is trying to get as much of Ukraine as he can. So Trump is trying to force him to accept a formula where Ukraine gives up some more territory in the east, but they get sovereignty and they get security. And it's tough to get Putin to the table to agree to that because he really doesn't have a lot to lose by continuing the war. I think they'll get an agreement. I think it's going to take a few more months. And my concern at this point is what do we do when Putin starts violating it, which he probably will. And I'm going on too long, Joe, but I think that's probably why Trump has not hit Putin with more sanctions than he has to this point, and maybe going after the shadow oil fleet, because he's saving that as leverage to enforce the agreement when he gets it. He's just using diplomacy, basically, at this point.
You talk about enforcing it. If that agreement does show up, if Trump is able to get an agreement between the two countries, and like you said, Putin violates it, I mean, what does the United States do, in your opinion, at that moment? I know we're talking purely hypothetical because we're not even there yet, but if we got to that point and Putin did violate it, what does the United States of America do in that situation?
Yeah, and let's take a concrete example of what might happen. So say the agreement provides for some kind of demilitarized zone in Donetsk region, right? Okay, who's going to enforce that? Here, the weakness of the Europeans is a real problem. I mean, I don't think they could put a division of troops on a rotational basis in that DMZ. And we don't want to put American troops there. I don't think anybody over here, you know, wherever they are on the spectrum, wants to do that. I mean, Ukraine's not a NATO ally. So what do we do if Putin says, okay, it's a DMZ and I'll police it with Russian troops? See, that's the kind of thing. So there are tools we still have. I mean, the stronger financial sanctions that I mentioned before, the shadow oil fleet, which, by the way, that's what we're capturing in Venezuela. That's their shadow oil fleet. We could do that. There are other things we can do, but – you know, we have a limited number of bullets available, if you want to put it that way. And I kind of think Trump is saving them to try and make certain that when he gets the agreement, we're able to put some pressure on Putin to comply with it. Now, it's why I say it's a very tough nut to crack. And it's ironic, but it's because the war has gone so badly for Putin. And this is what I really think. I mean, he's captured territory about half the size of the state of New York, lost a million men. I mean, he's basically become a gas station for China now. And this whole thing was a huge strategic blunder, but getting out of it is difficult. I mean, a blunder for Putin.
I mean, it's amazing. It started when my wife and I were on our honeymoon, and we've been married for 4 years. Sure. So, yeah. I mean, when I think of this conflict, I think of following it along like halfway through our honeymoon and can't believe it's gone on so long.
He's grinding up people. I mean, their policy, the Russians the last 6 months or so, is trying to save equipment, and they're sacrificing men instead. I personally believe, and I'm not, you know, getting briefed on the classified stuff anymore, but I think the casualties are worse than they're letting on, but they are gradually gaining ground on the battlefield. So that's another problem, is getting him to agree when he is, you know, winning, quote unquote, at enormous cost, but winning. So he does have constituencies in Russia he has to satisfy, the super patriotic military bloggers, that whole group of people. And he's got to be able to go back with something. When they look at what the cost Russia has paid for this war and how their strategic position has deteriorated, not just in Europe, but as I said, in the Middle East and the Black, they don't dominate the Black Sea anymore. They did before this war started, but the Ukraine sunk, I think, about a third of their navy. This has not been good for Russia, but it's ironically making it difficult to get an agreement. And we need an agreement because it's not in our interests to have, you know, Eastern Europe destabilized by a war like this.
Sir, let's move on to the Netanyahu meeting. The president met with Prime Minister Netanyahu yesterday. I mean, that whole situation, number one, you know, the meeting with Trump, they're obviously very good friends. And number two, I mean, is the Middle East just always going to be an issue?
Yeah, well, yes, but there's really a lot of good news. In fact, because the situation in the Middle East has changed markedly in our favor and in favor of a secure and reasonable peace, which is, again, what we want in the Middle East. I mean, we want to protect the homeland, and we and the Israelis have eliminated the major threat in the Middle East of that, which was the Iranian nuclear program. And then we want a stable Middle East. And we're in a much better position to get it now because the Israelis have emerged as what the scholars call the hegemon in the Middle East. I mean, they can dominate their strategic environment militarily, and they're doing it. I mean, they're in southern they're occupying parts of southern Lebanon now, parts of southern Syria, over half of Gaza. You know, they've attacked successfully Iran in Iran. I mean, now it's just a question of coordinating among allies. And what they agreed on was that, look, if the Iranians try and rebuild their ballistic missile program, much less their nuclear program, the Israelis can strike at them. I mean, Trump made that very clear. And then the other thing is, we can't go to phase two of the Gaza peace agreement unless and until Hamas is disarmed. Because you put an international stabilization force, quote unquote, in there, and Hamas is still active and still armed, then they'll use the international stabilization force as a shield, just as they've used civilians as a shield. So, and Trump made that very clear. I can't remember exactly what he said, but look, they agreed to disarm, he said, and if they don't disarm, basically said they're going to wish they had. And that means the Israelis have the freedom to continue going after Hamas. I mean, they're the police force in the region. But really, Joe, I mean, they are the kind of ally we're seeking in other places. They don't just share the burden, they own the burden. And then all we have to do, which is not easy, but is to provide the diplomatic leadership and use our economic power to get other countries to partner in a general peace, which is why Trump's been on this charm offensive with the Saudis, you've noticed. Because he wants the Saudis to join the Abraham Accords, and he wants those accords to include everybody in the Gulf states, Egypt, Jordan, and Syria also. Now, one issue is The Israelis want all that, too. So there's an agreement on what we want in the long term. But the Israelis, for understandable reasons, are much less willing to accept risk to get it, right? So because, like Syria, we're willing to take a chance on this new guy. The Israelis less so, because if, you know, if it turns out that he's a radical, they're the ones that are going to be in the receiving end. So those are the kinds of things that Trump and Netanyahu have to work out. But I'm about as optimistic as I've ever been about the Middle East.
Now let's move to China and the live ammo training near Taiwan. What do you take of this, and what does this mean for the United States of America? What and how would the United States get involved in this situation if it progressed?
Yeah. Well, this is all part of a multi-year pressure campaign the Chinese have been engaged in to isolate Taiwan, to demoralize them, to exhaust them through, you know, for example, they're constantly doing these kind of exercises. The Taiwanese have to scramble their air force and all this stuff to exhaust them so that they agree to, like, a, you know, like Munich in 1938, they agree to some amalgamation with the mainland where they give up their democracy. That's what the Chinese are trying to get. They would vastly prefer not to actually have to move militarily against Taiwan, although they're training for it. I mean, the PLA, the People's Liberation Army, has been training for decades to be able to do this if they need to, either an invasion or a blockade. But that contains considerable risk for them, because obviously they could end up in a war with us, and then that would also include very probably the Japanese, the Australians. They don't want that. So this is a pressure campaign, and we are countering it by building up our alliances, hence Trump's trip to East Asia earlier in the year, as well as taking steps to assist the Taiwanese to build up their own self-defense capabilities. But it's a real danger. I mean, we are in a period of risk in the Indo-Pacific that's higher than it should be. And it's, you know, a big part of the reason is we have not sustained our naval power there. Don't get me going on that, Joe. That's not an optimistic end of year message. But we're outnumbered in ships west of Hawaii 6-7 to 1. And
is that something that's being worked on?
Yeah, I mean, they made Trump had been in office a month when he issued his first executive order on the maritime industrial base. The problem is we lost a lot of our shipbuilding capability beginning in the 90s. And I will say I was in Congress at the time, and I made mistakes in my career, but this was not one of them. I screamed bloody murder about it. The Chinese have vastly more shipbuilding capability than we do. And it's not just a matter of ships, but they're really trying to rebuild, and I think they will. But this is an area, I mean, Joe, you can change intention quickly. And that happened on January 21st when Trump took office. But changing capability is a lot slower. You can't flip a switch and you get a new shipyard. So it's going to take some time, and there's going to be a higher level of risk in the meantime. I mean, there are things we can do to strengthen deterrence, and they're moving to do it. This new frigate program, which they can produce more quickly, that'll put more hulls in the water, but it's still going to take a little time.
Well, Senator, if we didn't have a clock to follow, I could talk with you the rest of the hour. I really appreciate the time and hope you have a very happy new year.
Yeah, happy new year to you and all your listeners. And listen, we're moving in the right direction in all of these places, and I want people to be encouraged. But yeah, it's a risky world, and we always have to be vigilant. Fortunately, we have enormous reservoirs of power and influence around the world, and we're using them now. So that's the good news.
That is indeed. He is Jim Talent, former U.S. Senator from Missouri. We'll be back. It's Joe Beamer in for Mark Reardon on 97.1 FM Talk.
Get more at 97.1talk.com.
Your true crime podcast keeps listeners on the edge of their seats. But here's the real mystery. Why isn't it making more money? Odyssey Creator Lab is here to solve that. We host your show for free. No fees, no catch. You focus on the suspense, while our sales team brings in advertisers and revenue. Stop leaving money on the table. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and turn your passion for true crime into real revenue.